Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Berkshire Grown presents Dan Barber, Future of Food, in conversation with Elizabeth Colbert on Monday, August 18th at 7 o'clock at the Mahawi in Great Barrington. Dan Barber, Blue Hills chef and co-owner, is the author of the new book, The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. Elizabeth Colbert is the author of The Sixth Extinction and Field Notes from a Catastrophe. It's a great pleasure to welcome both Elizabeth Colbert and Dan Barber to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Dan, let us begin with you of how this event came to be, of talking of the future of food.
Well, I wrote the book, The Third Plate, and largely it's based on my research with some ingredients that I loved in my kitchen, and I went about exploring how they were grown or raised. And in the book, I dial back further to my experiences growing up, in part on my grandmother's farm in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, called Blue Hill Farm, which is now a working dairy farm. Back then, it was a pasture-raising farm for beef cattle, which I worked on as a child growing up.
Elizabeth, when you think about it in a global sense, how does what Dan is doing of looking at the future of food fit into your work ultimately?
Dan's book is really, you know, looking at in its most profound level how what we eat, you know, should really be dictated by what's available and what we can eat sustainably, which is a huge question as there are now, you know, 7.2 billion of us on the planet. And, you know, just eating these days and I should say always has been one of the ways that human beings have made a major impact and growing impact, you know, on the planet. This goes all the way back to, you know, when we hunted, you know, mammoths and mastodons and moas, you know, which were sort of hunted to oblivion a long time ago. So we've been having a big impact just by eating sort of since we arrived. And, you know, my latest book is about extinction, and certainly what we consume is a big part of the issue.
And I was influenced by Ms. Colbert's writing, and we are also friends, and in talking with her, and maybe unconsciously, this helped, you know, frame the book in the sense that I was struck and encouraged by how, in the search for these ingredients that tasted delicious in my kitchen, when I learned the recipe for how they're grown and raised, I came to the conclusion that in every case, the most delicious food had a farming practice attached to it that was beneficial to the environment for which it was raised. So in many ways, that's a thought that is a little bit obvious in the sense that, like, a really delicious, you know, carrot, for instance, which I touch on in the book, can't possibly come from soils that are denuded or treated poorly. But if you take that idea and you extrapolate to a whole menu and to a diet and you multiply that over a region like the Berkshires or a population like our country and even further, you get to, you know, the conclusion of the book, which for me was that we have the opportunity and the possibility of creating a delicious and healthy diet that actually improves the landscape, which is a heartening thing, because we often talk about, as Elizabeth mentioned, that we often talk about agriculture as destructive to diversity and destructive to ecosystems. And in the case of really good eating and truly sustainable eating, we're talking about enjoying good food and nutritious food, but also improving a landscape and improving diversity along the way.
Elizabeth, it's worth noting that both of you have books with field notes in the title. So does that indicate a commonality in the way you work and the way you look at these issues, do you think?
You know, there are a lot of commonalities, which I certainly extend to a lot of nonfiction writers, so I certainly don't want to say it's, you know, some unique bond here. But, you know, those of us who write nonfiction, and Dan has the extraordinary, is in the extraordinary position of being both a great cook and a good writer, which is, you know, pretty unusual. But those of us who write nonfiction just, you know, generally go out into the world and we talk to people, and both of our books are structured as a series of sort of learning experiences for us and hopefully for the reader, you know, along the way. And as I say, that's not an uncommon way to structure a nonfiction book, but I think there are a lot of commonalities.
What Elizabeth is saying is that I softly plagiarized her title, which I did because
I softly plagiarized from other people. So it's a pretty and from the field notebooks that I often, you know, go out with people who they're wonderful waterproof field notebooks that people carry around. So it's not exactly a, you know, it's a very, very common trope as a.
Dan, what was it like to come to a realization over time that the farm-to-table movement wasn't doing enough to have a lasting impact on the food system?
I had this experience of early on in the research. This is, goes back, feels like a lifetime. It goes back about 10 years when I really started the book because I was looking for a bread to bake in my restaurant that I could supply with local wheat. And I found a farmer I ended up really admiring named Klaus Martens in upstate New York. And he was supplying this fantastic emmer wheat for this bread that we started serving actually as a course in our restaurant that our diners loved. It was super delicious and nutty, and people came looking forward as they'd heard from their friends and neighbors about this bread. And so I decided to go learn how he grew this wheat, and I was standing in the middle. Klaus Martens has a farm in Penyon, New York. That's probably 2,000, a little over 2,000 acres. It's really enormous when you, actually by grain standards, it's quite small. But for me, it was an experience to stand in the middle of 2,000 plus acres. And you know, I came to study this wheat, and I looked around and spent the day with Klaus, and I never saw any wheat. And what I instead learned about. It was a real schooling, actually, in soil health. And what surrounded me were a suite of other crops, like buckwheat and barley, and millet and rye. And then there were traditional cover crops like vetch and clover. And there were leguminous crops with all these different kinds of peas and Austrian winter peas, which improved the soil dramatically. And so I was surrounded by this. You know, diversity of grains and leguminous crops at a farm that was specialized for me in wheat. And I realized, you know, quickly, although I would say it really sunk in after spending many years getting to know Klaus and his farming strategy, that here I was as a farm-to-table chef celebrating wheat, local flour from my restaurant, which is a good thing. But if I really wanted to celebrate the farm and the farmer, I needed to support everything that this farmer was growing in order to get his soil prepped and ready for this delicious wheat. In other words, what I was standing around was really a recipe, all these different crops, for soil health, that he was planting this diversity to increase the microbial activity in a soil to get it to the point where it could grow this delicious wheat. And so in order to celebrate the wheat, I really needed to not only buy the wheat, but I also needed to buy all these other crops that enabled him to be able to grow such a delicious wheat for my bread. So that led to this sort of realization that the farm-to-table movement, unfortunately, doesn't force you, the eater or the chef, into looking at a menu that supports the entire farm. It allows you to cherry pick ingredients. And in my case, I was a famous cherry picker because I was celebrating these crops for which I covet, and we all covet. We all covet wheat, and you could extend this right now in this season to crops like zucchini and tomatoes and eggplant. But without looking at the entirety of the farm, which is to say what the farmer needs to plant to get the kind of fertility he or she needs to give us these very coveted crops, then we aren't thinking, eating, or cooking with a kind of true sustainability in mind.
Elizabeth, I think it's interesting that as a wonderful writer who has written books, and just using the most recent examples of Field Notes from a Catastrophe and The Sixth Extinction being your most recent book, when you use extinction and catastrophe in your titles, where does your optimism lie that we can achieve what Dan is talking about?
Where does my optimism lie? You know, on some level, it doesn't lie anywhere.
Right.
I'm going to be really frank. But I think that, you know, what Dan is trying to do is challenge people, really, to think about the totality, you know, in the sense of food, of the system. And I think, I guess, you know, to sort of piggyback on that, I like to think that, you know, that's what I am. I'm also trying to challenge people to think about that, you know, what we do has tremendous ramifications, and this extends, you know, far beyond food, because food is really our most basic, you know, besides breathing air, which is crucially important, and drinking water, we eat from the environment. And you know, when people ask me sometimes, why should I care, for example, why should I care about climate change? You know, what I have, the answer that I've developed, which, you know, sounds sort of glib, but I think is ultimately true, is, you know, do you like to eat? If you like to eat, you should care about climate change, because it's going to affect what we can grow, where we can grow, how much we can grow, water availability. And I think, you know, that everything that we do, if we're going to address all of these really, really profound issues, and address, I use that word really, really loosely, because, you know, a lot of damage is being done, you know, even as we speak, and really can't be undone in a human time scale. But if we're going to try to minimize that, we need to be thinking really, really big about systems that are very, very, very big beyond, you know, any of our own individual powers, and yet we really have to, you know, start with thinking about our individual actions and our place as a political actor, because that is really all any of us have as an individual.
Dan, where do you come down on optimism?
I'm not an optimist. I've never been accused of being an optimistic guy. I have to say that. You know, I feel optimistic after writing this book, in part because I spent 10 years with farmers and communities, farming communities, really regions they ended up being. One that was especially promising was a 2,000-year-old farming system called the Dehesa in southern Spain, over 2,000 years, really sculpted landscape. That's a good example of a natural system that never produced. The Dehesa is located in the Extremadura region of Spain, which is loosely translated as an extra hard landscape, you know, a landscape that doesn't produce abundance with, you know, great consistency. And the Dehesa was sculpted by human hands over 2,000 years to produce incredible abundance of delicious food that is regenerative for the environment. It actually promotes from those microbial activity in the soil all the way to bird life and everything in between. And it promotes it through the cultivation and harvest of a real diversity of ingredients. It's led by pigs, by the famous Jamón Ibérico, which is the coveted, very expensive hams of one of the more expensive foods in the world. But there are a whole host, and in fact, an entire cuisine and a population of people that have been eating to support the landscape that gives you the Jamón Ibérico, but also a heck of a lot of other delicious foods. So a landscape that has been sculpted to provide abundance and improve the landscape over the course of 2,000 years seems to me to be a very inspiring and optimistic opportunity to look at what's possible with food production. And I go from there to the Skagit Valley of Washington State, where there's a wheat breeder, a man who has opted out of the conventional wheat breeding game. His name is Steve Jones, and he sort of becomes the hero of the end of the book, sort of the future of what's possible, because he's breeding wheat he's selecting wheat for flavor and for nutrient density, and he's doing it also with the promise of wheat needing a lot less water, a lot less nitrogen to grow. He's really breeding it for small organic systems. And we eat a ton. We eat more than anything else. There's 60 million acres of wheat. And so if we can change wheat, we can start to see how we can sculpt. If we can change what the needs of wheat, we can start to see how we might sculpt our landscape in different ways to provide for our diet. So I'm optimistic. You know, I'm talking a lot about agriculture in part because I'm on the phone with Elizabeth, but I am a chef, and the book is really about cooking and how we think about and approach our everyday diets. And the American diet is probably not a way to arrive at an optimistic viewpoint of the idea of the future of agriculture, because it's an anomaly. The American expectation of a protein-centric plate of food for lunch and dinner 7 days a week is an agricultural really phenomenon that America was able to provide because of its soil health and incredible agricultural bounty up until really this point. And what we are right now is in a fork in the road where we need to decide how are we going to provide for a growing population and how are we going to do it in a way that's a lot more elegant and less destructive than our food production now. And so that's the challenge. It seems to me like we ought to look to these farmers and to these regions that I'm talking about, but also look at our own diets, because as Elizabeth says, it's you know, this is a political issue, and one way to dial into the politics, as others have said, and Michael Pollan famously says, is to vote with our forks. We have the opportunity to do that three times a day. And so, to me, as long as we're pursuing deliciousness, as long as we are greedy for truly good food, we are voting for ultimately the right kind of agriculture for the future.
Berkshire Grown is presenting the event Beyond Farm to Table, The Future of Food, Dan Barber in conversation with Elizabeth Colbert. It takes place Monday, August 18th at 7 p.m. at the Mahawi Theater in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Elizabeth Colbert is the author of The Sixth Extinction. Dan Barber's new book is The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food. Dan and Elizabeth, thank you very much for joining us this morning. I thank you very much and have a wonderful event.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Again, you can find out more information about the event by going to berkshiregrown.org, berkshiregrown.org, or mahawi.org, mahawi.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.